This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. And 2019 has been a very busy year for many different topics here in Northwest Indiana. One of them in particular is the immigration issue. And we have a gentleman who's eminently well qualified to talk about that. Alfredo Estrada is a partner with the law firm of Burke, Costanza & Carberry here in Northwest Indiana. In fact, he's the co-chairperson of the firm's immigration practice group. And we've had him on before. In fact, the last time we had a chance to talk at length with him was 3 years ago. That was when he was one of the panel members for a special public forum that we held on the issue of immigration. That was held at Purdue University Northwest in the Room with a View conference room on campus in Hammond. And we are lucky to have Alfredo back with us here in the studio today. Thank you for joining us on Regionally Speaking.
Well, thanks for having me, Chris.
Well, if you will give us an idea of, at least in your view and with the information that you get to gather from all of your sources, how 2019 seemed to go on the issues, and several of them I know, on immigration, Northwest Indiana, how the general region, as well as the nation, if necessary.
Well, here regionally, I think what we've seen is the continued litigation of the Welcome City Ordinances in Gary and East Chicago, and I believe those are still going forward with the cities defending them, and then some local entities as well, municipalities adopting the DACA, support of DACA and DREAMer resolutions. During this time last year, there was that uptick in, raids either at local establishments or construction sites, and we haven't seen any change in that here recently.
I think one most notable raid was one that happened at a restaurant in Porter County that really got a lot of people upset about that and brought a lot of attention as well in the media.
Yeah, there were two Porter County restaurants that got raided along with a East Chicago site all on the same day, the day before Christmas Eve of 2018. So and then that carried into 2019, but that was really an infamous raid, and that's where the excise police kind of work with immigration, get the warrant to search and look into establishments due to excise violation and coordinate that raid with immigration.
Did it turn out that those were some of the incidents that could probably qualify as not only both the high points but the low points as well?
Well, yeah, nobody. I don't think the community, at least my opinion, the community doesn't like to see individuals who run good establishments in their community go through that. So I don't know the high points as to immigration enforcement for sure. That's what ICE is. Their purpose is, and then low points maybe within the community.
When you talk about what ICE has been doing here, a lot of times we take a look not only at these raids that have been conducted and these two that got a lot of attention here, as you mentioned, at the end of 2017 going into last year, but also, too, the flights, the immigration flights out of Gary Chicago International Airport. It's been a while since we've been aware. I'm sure they have been going on, but they've actually come public. Bring us, an idea of what these flights are all about and why it's so important to be sure that they are tracked.
Well, the flights are when an individual gets placed into removal proceedings, they go through their due process hearing and are allowed to submit defenses or cancellation and deportation proceedings. And after the hearings are conducted, there's an order of removal given. And generally, the ones who are flown out of the Gary International Airport are those who are on the detained docket, meaning they're in detention by immigration. They haven't been given a bond. They're not necessarily the ones who go through that process while not in detention. So they're still ongoing, as far as I know. And, I think it's important that to know what's going on in our airport. It's our local airport here. And whether you have an opinion on whether it should be or shouldn't be, that's up to the listener, though.
I know the detention issue has been going on for quite some time, and in particular, it's even stretched into Illinois, because I understand in particular that these cases have come up with those detainees that fly out of the Gary Airport are brought over from Illinois in particular. Tell us about how they've been kept over there and the situation that involves them and not being able to get, certainly not to go through the process of being allowed to stay home.
Yeah, so there's five detention, long-term detention facilities within our district, and there's four in Illinois and one in Wisconsin. There's a short-term detention center in Brazil, Indiana, mm-hmm. that mainly focuses on individuals who are picked up by ICE and detained short time around the Indianapolis or southern part of the state. So the individual waits, you know, is processed, is allowed a bond hearing, and if it's not granted bond, must stay within their time of deportation proceedings within those contracted facilities, which are mostly county jails contracted by ICE to hold individuals.
Are we finding the same problems that come up with ICE and with detention and with other cases involving immigration, in particular with folks who don't have the documentation in other parts of Indiana, or do they seem to be focused up here and maybe perhaps in Indianapolis?
You know, I have clients all over the state.
Yeah.
Eastern border, western border, south, down towards the Kentucky border as well, Indianapolis area, all over the state. So I think there's a presence and an enforcement that is broad.
When we take a look at what's being done locally here, I guess maybe we should say what should be done locally if it hasn't already been done or could maybe, as we go into this new year, be done to deal with some of these issues involving immigration. And then let's take a look at the little broader picture in particular on the statewide and the national level.
Well, locally, I think, you know, what they've done locally here is for activists and community residents to push resolutions within their own municipalities. East Chicago and Hammond, recently Hammond just passed their resolution in support of DACA and DREAMer, the DREAM Act. And that took some time, but when I was there at the Hammond City Council, it was a packed room because of that resolution. So I think locally, individuals who support these things could, you know, speak to their local officials on doing those. And they're non-binding, but it's a way to get the issue out that the cities are in support of their residents within their cities or counties that may be DACA or DREAMer or immigrants.
Mm-hmm.
Statewide, you know, last year I know there was some believe there was a bill in committee regarding undocumented able to receive a driver's license. Many states around the nation are allowing undocumented to receive a driver's license on the premise that it increased security for police officers to know who's driving the car, brings insurance rates down because everybody could then they can then get insurance and things of that nature. And there was also a bill in the Senate by Senator Eddie Melton that would outlaw for-profit detention centers. That didn't get out of committee, did not get out of committee. But, you know, I'm not sure if they're going to bring both of those back. Earl Harris, and state representative Earl Harris out of Chicago, brought a bill in committee to allow in-state tuition for individuals who may not be documented but graduated from a state high school. So those are some bills that were down at committee. None of them, I believe, left. But those are things locally and statewide that I think have been moving towards coming to its day.
If you'll go back to the measure that got through the Hammond Common Council, the resolution that actually I understand was the second time around for it, that it went through once or went up before the council members once before, didn't make it, and then finally this year, this past year we should say, in this recent month of December, it finally came up before the Hammond Common Council and was approved. Tell us a little bit about the differences between those two bills or two resolutions, mm-hmm. I should say.
So former Councilman Anthony Higgs first brought the resolution to the council maybe a year and a half ago, and it didn't receive a second. There was some change in language that allowed the council to feel more comfortable that it would lessen the risk or really be no risk of litigation regarding Welcome City and the removal of federal funds due to the passing of the resolution. So once we ironed out that language with the city council, there was a lot more community support this second time around for the resolution. It passed 9-0, and all members of the council put their name in as authors.
Now, you we talk about, I guess, the interest in, and I guess even in the news nationally about coming up with a comprehensive immigration reform proposal. What, in your view, would that look like?
Well, you know, the last time we had any type of immigration reform was in 2001, and there's some particular things that we could do to address the reality of immigration here in the United States and still have keep the best interests of our country in mind. But what needs to be done is first for us to admit that there's two different separate issues regarding immigration. And one is family, keeping U.S. citizen families together. There's kids who have U.S. citizen parents who may be immigrants, keeping those families together and making sure the statutes reflect that reality. And the second are border and national security interests. Those are two separate issues that we can address separately and still have a workable act in Immigration Nationality Act that would address the realities that we have. So I think any type of comprehensive immigration reform is first going to be first and foremost anything that would address Dreamers, right? There was a Dream Act that's bipartisan support, but has always failed to be passed. That a large amount of the citizens in our country support, and whether that we could get that passed or address that issue is going to be, I think, a litmus test to see if we could get comprehensive immigration reform passed. I think if you look at the presidential candidates and their immigration platform, they address what's known as the 3 and 10 year bars. Those are for individuals who have a year of unlawful presence. They get a 3 year bar if they return back to their foreign country. Mm-hmm. And if they have more than a year and return to their foreign country, they trigger a 10 year bar. Mayor Buttigieg, former presidential candidate Castro, and I believe Elizabeth Warren, all proposed that those bars be eradicated, that the 212A9B bars are gone. So the individual could then does not need a waiver to seek relief from that inadmissibility and could go through the consular processing a bit smoother. But I think more importantly, there's a former act. It's called the Legal Immigration Family Equity Act, and it was passed under the George H. Bush administration and then reenacted by President Clinton. That allows an individual who came here undocumented or overstayed a visa who has a petition prior to a certain date to pay a fine and then adjust status here in the United States. It doesn't require them to go to their home country to obtain their legal permanent residency. And what that does, it focuses on the reality that there are families that are dependent upon these immigrants and they need to stay intact, in that a departure to their home country for a significant amount of time is harmful to those U.S. citizen families. So that has not been reenacted. The date right now is April 31st, 2001. So it's been 19 years since we have addressed this question. And it was bipartisan then. It makes the individual pay a fee, a penalty. And I think it's something that Congress could reenact pretty quickly to update that date and address the reality of immigration here in the country.
When we talk about Congress, since this has become obviously a very important national issue, even though it does touch Northwest Indiana. Northwest Indiana has an opportunity to be able to vote on a selection for a new member of Congress. As we know that Congressman Pete Viscoski has decided not to seek re-election. And there are a number of people in the Democratic primary election coming up on May 5th that would like to take his, at least be on the ballot, to be able to take his seat in the general election in November. What are your views about what you know about the candidates have announced so far that they're interested in being on the ballot in May?
Yeah, so out of the maybe 7 that have announced, I've spoke with 4 of them, mm-hmm, regarding multiple issues, but of one of them being immigration. I think all of the 4 that I spoke with all have a good heart and intention when coming to immigration reform and understand there needs to be at least some change. I would like to see them develop their platform on it and to maybe get a little bit more educated on what exactly needs to be done in order when they're in Washington to address the issue.
Do you think that it's in this case because it's very early in the process? In fact, candidates haven't officially, although I'm sure they have already, but they officially haven't necessarily filed their paperwork to, mm-hmm, become candidates. They have a little bit of time left this month to do that, but they have to do it, obviously. Do you see, at least in your discussions with the candidates, and I'm sure you'll have more as time goes on here during the early stages of the primary election campaign with these folks, Do you see anything in particular that you want to get from them, or you see that in their proposals, their platforms, planks about these particular issues?
Well, I think the first thing you want to, just personally, what first thing I want to see is there's an interest in immigration reform and whether they understand that there's a need for one and the ability to comprehend the complex issues that are within this country. So that I've spoke generally with them, and I think they all have the intention of addressing the issue, if possible, and while they're if they become congressmen. So we'll see. I think what it will do is cause a bit of debate within this primary election, and I'm interested to see what type of platform and how they develop that issue and how they would advocate for immigration reform.
We talked here about what the local governments are doing in the issue of immigration. We talk about here about the impending candidates for the congressional seat that's open with the primary election coming up first. What can Northwest Indiana Citizens General do about the issue of immigration?
One thing I like to do is speak truth about the topic, right? Mm-hmm. There's a lot of rhetoric out there on immigration, and I think what we could do is speak truth about it, and then come to a bit of a recognition that our economies, our communities, all depend upon immigrants, whether we like it or not. Right now, that's where we're at. So, what they could do is just brush up on the topic, see the truth in all of it.
It's quite a topic to take on, and a lot of research that many people probably have to do. But I'm sure it's something as we go on into the 2020 months ahead before the elections. It's something to keep an eye on what the candidates have to say about it, and make a wise choice at the ballot box in May, to be sure. And Alfredo, thank you for spending time with us to talk about the issue overall, about immigration reform, about the issues here in Northwest Indiana, and a look ahead is what the candidates will be running for office coming up have to say about the issue, and we hope to have you back here during the months ahead to talk more about it.
No, let me know. Thanks for having me.
Thank you. Alfredo Estrada is a partner with Burke Constanza and Carberry Law Firm here in Northwest Indiana. He focuses, among on other practices, on immigration as well. And you're listening to Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. State Representative Chris Chung is with his Northwest Indiana legislative colleagues in Indianapolis for the 2020 General Assembly session. I had a chance to sit down with Mr. Chung in a quiet conference room at a Lake County Public Library branch in his district last week to talk with him about the session and about the issues. As we go into this very first week, very first days, literally days of the General Assembly session, first, what do you have planned in representing the district here in Northwest Indiana?
Yeah, so for me, it's always been about education and healthcare, especially. Those are key planks of our agenda. And this year, I'm also focusing on some labor issues related to the recent story about Amazon and operating in central Indiana and the death of a worker and the investigation that happened thereafter, and where there's accusations of misconduct there and unethical behavior by the Indiana OSHA. So I'm concerned about those, and we're going to introduce some legislation potentially via bill or via amendment form. But for me, I would say the two most exciting bills that I will be introducing myself, even though they're not related to education or healthcare, I'm hoping that they'll go to my own committees, though. One is on payday lending, which was a big topic last year because it didn't necessarily fall along strict partisan lines. We had Republicans voting with Democrats as well against the payday lending proposal. So what I'm proposing is closing the online payday lending loophole. It's something that the industry, the payday lobby industry, has been saying, well, since we have storefront payday lending in Indiana, we're subject to more rules than the online lenders who aren't subject to the same rules. So then we said, well, we have to close that loophole. Thanks for letting us know. I'm hoping that will go back to financial institutions on the committee that I serve. And then the other one I'm hoping that will go to local government, which I'm a ranking minority member on, is source of income discrimination for renters. Basically, if you are a credit creditworthy, no criminal background, tenant who's able to pay the full market asking price for rent, you can still be discriminated against just because you're dependent on a federal voucher known as Section 8, which to me I think is crazy because a dollar is a dollar no matter how you earned it. Mm-hmm. So I would say those two I'm most excited about.
Let's go back to the payday lending issue here. Is that a major problem that you have seen or you have gotten word from your constituents on here in Northwest Indiana?
You know, in my district immediately, I don't think there are that many people who use payday lenders. So it's mainly in the surrounding communities, North Lake County, the urban areas, lower income areas that are really suffering under this. But as I'm a member on the Financial Institutions Committee, we do see a real need to rein these operators in because anyone is just one big medical bill or one car repair away from financial instability. And we don't want to exacerbate that, which is what all of the evidence shows. If we expand dramatically triple-digit rate APR short-term interest loans to Hoosiers, then we are putting them at more financial risk, and that's not the direction we want to move in.
Now, it may or may not be perceived as such, but this could be probably an issue that goes back into the 20th century of loan sharking, which has been proven with many, many times and instances and evidence that organized crime is deeply involved in loan sharking. Do you think that the payday lending issue is something that's related, or it may not be quite as devious, maybe not quite as criminal, but just same, it's pretty serious?
Yeah, the industry is more dressed up nowadays, to be quite frank about it. But on that point, it is a good parallel you can draw between old-fashioned times, because we're talking about usury here as well. We in the last session, we joined alliances with the religious community, the faith-based community, because they were saying, look, if you pass this law, it's biblical usury. We're not going to support this. We also teamed up with veterans who are preyed on a lot of times on these short-term high-interest rate loans. So it was kind of a strange bedfellows type mix that we were able to defeat last year's proposal.
On the issue about the housing question, about vouchers and the financial value of them, is this an issue that it's kind of mainly federal in some respect because it's FHA and HUD in this case with the vouchers? Is this an issue that Northwest Indiana tends to face more or the more urban counties in Indiana?
Yeah, absolutely. It is in the urban counties, but also increasingly in the rural communities, we're seeing evictions go up and we're seeing more people with less stability in their own housing options. And this bill is all about providing people the opportunity to put their first, to grab the first rung of that ladder of economic prosperity and get themselves out of poverty. Why are we limiting housing freedom choices to lower income people, which historically traps them into poverty based on statistics and data, instead of allowing them more options as to where they can live and for them to get into the more upwardly mobile communities? Absolutely.
I'm sure you had opportunities to talk with your colleagues at the House and the Senate here in Northwest Indiana about the issues. What do you see as the issues going into this 2020 General Assembly session?
We anticipate overall that it will be a quick session for a few reasons, but it doesn't seem like there's many ambitious proposals by leadership to do very much this year, which can be frustrating to some people who want to see government taking a more active role and can be pleasing to people who want to see government have a less active role. We were very vocal last year on the education front about raising teacher salaries. We have the lowest paid teachers in the Midwest. We have some of the lowest per capita funding in the entire country. We are number one in the nation in cuts to teacher pay in the last decade. These are statistics that we do not want to have on Indiana's badge. We really want to be able to show that we're doing all we can for education, but the leadership, frankly, has not shown the initiative to step up to the plate on that.
I know that's also been one issue, the teacher pay and any kind of financial issues has been brought up. Even State Senator Karen Talion has said some time ago that she hopes that if it's been discovered that there's some money that's available that can be readjusted in the budget, even though the budget itself is pretty much locked in for the rest of the cycle, that they ought to at least take advantage and reallocate some of that money to some of these areas that need it the most.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, tax collections are high. It's a strong, relatively strong economy from a few years ago. If we're not paying our teachers in a strong economy like this, just imagine how terrible it could get in a recession when we have to make even more deep cuts to public services like education, like healthcare funding. That is what really concerns me about the future of Indiana.
Do you think that this is an election year, mainly for the not only for the state but for the federal government too? Of course, do you think that there's going to be some impact that we're going to see, maybe not necessarily on the floor of the Indiana House, but certainly in the state house in general, because we have the politics of the issues that are going to come about this time around?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, everyone plays politics. I'm cynical about it, and I'm kind of annoyed at my colleagues who go up there and grandstand or, you know, introduce bills that are strategic votes to jam each other on certain things. I mean, the inevitability is that it's going to happen. I don't know what form it's going to take with impeachment going on and with whatever new revelations might come out from that or on certain hot-button issues like redistricting for next year. These are all things that have a big federal impact, of course, and that we at the state level have a big platform and a voice to put out those issues on for sure.
So you think it's going to be a challenge to try to get some of these issues through the General Assembly with all this louder noise coming from Washington?
Yeah, I mean, I give credit to my colleagues. I think most of them, for the most part, are pretty good at tuning out what happens in Washington and able to work in a little bit more of a bipartisan fashion. And the priorities that I've chosen around helping renters climb out of poverty and on cybersecurity initiatives and on data protection and surveillance technology, some of the other bills that I've filed, all of those issues aren't super strict partisan bomb-throwing things, in my opinion. So I like to think that I'll be able to get Republican support on them, and that's just kind of how I operate. Not every legislator does operate in that vein. A lot of the times, the odds are against Democratic bills getting heard in committee just because of the partisan breakdown. But so they'll, you know, file something that they know has no chance but can be used as kind of like a rallying cry for their base, whereas I'm kind of like, let's try to get some business actually done for once.
Well, the best of luck to you in the upcoming session. This being a short session, so it's not going to be months long. It'll probably be, about 90 days or so, maybe at the most?
Yeah, probably even shorter at that from what we're hearing, maybe 70.
Well, that's a very, very real possibility. State Representative Chris Chung, thank you for being with us.
Thank you, Chris.
This is Ridgely Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. Purdue University Northwest School of Engineering is expanding and deepening its connections with local and regional business and industry in some new and novel ways, and one of them is a faculty internship program. The director of the school, Professor Dietmar Remfer, was on Regionally Speaking to talk about how the idea came about.
This is a program that was developed at the School of Engineering at Purdue Northwest. Ultimately, it went back to ideas that I had that I discussed with my external advisory board. I have a number of industry representatives in this external advisory board from local and regional industries. We have a lot of support from NIPSCO, NiSource. We have the steel industry. ArcelorMittal is involved there. And so together with those representatives, I brought up this idea at one of the external advisory board meetings, and we developed it from there.
Mm-hmm. Give us an idea which faculty members are most likely to be interested in becoming interns in this way, and also to what they may certainly be involved in if they pick a business or an industry out there, as I know that you're starting to have now with your very first intern out there.
So this is a program for all faculty in the School of Engineering at Purdue Northwest. And maybe going a little bit back to the background that this is built upon. Mm-hmm. One of the core ideas behind what we're doing with the School of Engineering, and going even further back, the School of Engineering at Purdue Northwest is a very new school. It was founded in the summer of 2017. I was hired as the founding director of the School of Engineering. We had two engineering departments before. We have a department of mechanical and civil engineering and a department of electrical and computer engineering. But then university leadership decided that we wanted to raise the profile of engineering at Purdue Northwest as a Purdue institution. Clearly, engineering should be one of the signature programs at the university. And so then the question is, how do we go about doing this? How do we raise the profile of engineering at Purdue Northwest and, frankly, in Northwest Indiana? And one of the things that are important to me personally as well is that a university and a school of engineering, they need to be embedded in the fabric of the region that is hosting them. So we want to build two-way relationships between the university, in my case, and of course, with the School of Engineering and the surrounding community of industry, innovators, communities, startup entrepreneurs, and all of these people. So the question is, how do we create these deeper connections? And so this faculty internship is one way to do this. Mm-hmm. The idea is that on the one hand, we allow our stakeholders, entrepreneurs, people in industry, communities, to take advantage of the expertise that our faculty have. So if they have projects that they would like to have some help on, then we can make faculty expertise available to them. So this way we can help our surrounding community with the expertise that our faculty have. And on the other hand, our faculty have the opportunity to learn about new approaches, to learn about the current problems that industry is dealing with, and then to bring this knowledge back to the classroom so that they can train our students better so that they stay up to date, and ultimately our students will be able to hit the ground running when they go back to industry.
Do you think that this is an opportunity that I know Purdue University, all of the campuses are very strong on, is experiential learning? To be able to get the student really ready for life outside of the Ivy walls, so to speak, and being ready to go out there in that profession that they would like to take on with their degree.
Yes, exactly. So experiential learning in all engineering schools across the nation, that is something that has become very important. If we go back in history a little bit, if you look at the way engineering schools were run in the 1950s, it turned out that actually the majority of faculty were people coming out of industry. They were practitioners. So the education of engineering graduates was very practically oriented. But then people realized that in order to have graduates that are ready for unknown challenges, for new technologies that are coming up, remember we were starting to think about going to the moon, there was this idea that our engineering graduates should be stronger on fundamentals. And this was the start of what was called the beginning of engineering science and the engineering scientist. And as a consequence, engineering departments became much more focused on hiring faculty that were scientists, that did research, and the education of engineers, certainly in four-year programs and beyond, became much more theoretical, which had all sorts of benefits. This was a good thing. So, as you know, we went to the moon and we developed all these new technologies. But there was a downside as well, in that the education became less practical, and industry started to notice that they needed to spend a significant amount of effort to take these graduates coming from engineering schools and make them ready to work and be productive for their enterprises. And so obviously time scales are relatively long. Things move slowly in academia sometimes. What happened then was there was more and more an emphasis on practical education. There is a central accrediting agency for engineering education, ABET, which then required all students to have what we call a capstone design experience. So this meant that practice-based learning and experiential learning became more important in engineering education. So fast forward to where we are now, all engineering schools that are accredited by ABET, meaning all engineering schools basically, have practice-based learning as part of their curriculum. So with this faculty internship, we're expanding the range of these things to not only have practice-based learning for our students, if you will, but also have practice-based learning and keep our faculty up to date with practice in industry.
That's the director of the Purdue University Northwest School of Engineering, Professor Dietmar Remfer. Maryville town officials broke ground recently on a major community center. The land wants the site of a drive-in theater along Broadway. It's going to be home to several athletic fields as well as a facility that, in the view of town councilman Sean Pettit, could rival Hammond's Sportsplex. Pettit was on Regionally Speaking to talk about it.
Well, one of the things that we did was we did a feasibility study. And a lot of people do studies, as we've seen here in Lake County. Mm-hmm. And studies that sit on the shelf and aren't implemented are basically worthless piece of paper. We took the feasibility study done by the Arsh Group, and they identified three potential locations, and the Y&W drive-in theater property was one of them. And we had the benefit of our former town manager, Bruce Spires, having a good relationship with the owner, Ron Rex. And we negotiated a price, and we purchased all 32 acres out of our Broadway TIF district.
What was, I guess, there, I guess, in recent years, was there anything there, I guess, maybe I should say, in recent years, after they took everything down, after they took the huge screen down and they cleared the lots away from all of the remote controls and the speakers that were out there on posts, you know, that were the part of concession stand that was all part of the property out there for the drive-in theater. What was sitting out there? Just land with trees growing on it?
Yeah, just scrub trees. There are many warehouses just to the north that was parceled out and was approved, and a partial street network and a couple of subdivided lots were on the front of Broadway, but there was nothing. It's vacant land mm-hmm. right now.
When you have this land to work with, where's it stand right now? I know you have a fence up, basically, to kind of block it off and to be able to get some work done. What's the contractor, and what work are they going to be able to do when the weather finally breaks this spring?
We've retained the building was designed by American Structure Point, who've done a fantastic job. They did the Hammond Sportsplex, which I had the pleasure of going to yesterday. And seeing firsthand how that turned out. We also have Core Construction as our construction management agent, and they are handling all the bidding. We've bid out approximately six different contracts in two bid packages. So they're doing the site work right now. Dyer Construction and Austin Construction are doing some site work as well. Reith Riley got the asphalt and concrete bid. And we will be doing our last bid package, hopefully on December 23rd, and that will include all of the remaining, the steel, the HVAC, the plumbing, the electric, and so everything will be done, and everyone will be under contract. So they might do some winter work. They're already clearing some land, doing some underground work with the storm sewers and things like that for the parking lot, and then come March, they'll really be hitting it, and we're hoping for a January 2021 opening.
Okay. Now, we know it's not been a project that has gone smooth sailing. You've had some bumps along the way, probably many more bumps that certainly you care to have on a project like this along the way. But are you finding that there are more and more residents in Merivale that are thinking about this, and they're realizing that this is probably a very good fit for the land that's there?
I think so, yeah. We needed a central location for this facility. We needed to offer the residents something in Merivale, especially the kids. A lot of our parks are smaller parks, neighborhood parks, so we thought through the feasibility study this would be an ideal situation. It's long overdue, as I've said, Chris, to have something like this. It's going to have three basketball courts that can convert to six volleyball courts. It's going to have a walking, elevated walking path in it. It's going to have a rock climbing wall, a fitness center, a 30,000 square foot room to be rented out for banquets or bridal showers or baby showers. The park offices will be there. It's just an absolute fantastic. And anyone that doubts the viability of this project that we're doing, I strongly encourage them to go up and see what Mayor McDermott's done with the Hammond Sportsplex. Mm-hmm. I was absolutely blown away yesterday when I went there for my daughter's volleyball tournament.
That's Merivale Town Councilman Sean Pettit in our conversation before the holidays. Indiana Humanities is ready to present another program that's linked to its inseparable initiative. It's a homegrown documentary film tour. Leah Nehemus says it begins next week. The first stop will be at the Duesenberg Recital Hall in the Center for the Arts at Valparaiso University. Tell us first a little bit about the series, how it came about, and about some of the interesting documentary filmmakers who are going to be displaying their wares.
Indiana Humanities put out a call for filmmakers to create short films about the ways that Hoosiers experience urban and rural identities today. And we weren't sure what we would get, but we were really pleased. We had a really competitive pool of proposals, and we selected five. All this past year, there have been five documentary film teams across the state creating short films, 10 to 20 minutes long, pretty much, about this larger question of kind of stories of Hoosiers today. We've been calling that the Inseparable Film Project because it's tied to our inseparable theme, which is looking at how we relate to each other across urban-rural lines. And two of the five films are about people or communities in Northwest Indiana and created by filmmakers based in Northwest Indiana.
That's great.
So the first of those is From Sundown to Sunrise, and that's by Pat Wisniewski and Tom Desch, and it looks at the story of the Cotton family who moved to Valparaiso in the 1960s and kind of their experience of being the first Black family in Valparaiso and, you know, kind of what generated, you know, what was the community's ways that folks in the community got involved in order to build housing and bring them from Chicago, as well as, you know, what it was like to go through that change. And then the other film that's from Northwest Indiana is by a filmmaker named Dan Rybicki, and it's called Larry from Gary, and it's looking at kind of the life and career, the trials and triumphs of dance instructor Larry Brewer and his amazing student performers at a nationally recognized art school in Gary, and kind of, you know, the story of that against the backdrop of kind of the disinvestment in Gary over time that has resulted in that school being closed, even though Larry is still teaching dance in other settings. So we're really excited to bring those films to 10 places across the state, along with three other films, I should say, starting in Valparaiso on January 15th, and then coming back to Northwest Indiana on May 6th up in Gary.
That you mentioned in particular, the ones with Pat Wisniewski and Tom Desch as the producers of From Sundown to Sunrise, and Dan Rybicki, his film Larry from Gary, are the ones, of course, of most interest here. But I know there's some others, even though they're not based in Northwest Indiana or of direct interest in Northwest Indiana, they have some interesting topics. And one in particular, which I know kind of covers a situation in eastern Indiana, is entitled Hometown Media. Ryan Gleason is the documentary filmmaker on that one. It's of interest, too, because it talks about local journalism, I understand.
You know, right now we all know that we're experiencing a time of real crisis for local media and local journalism. You know, the economic models that supported local journalism for a long time have, for the most part, really declined. Public media is actually one of the rare bright spots, I think. And then there's a larger question, like, what happens if you lose your local paper? And so these were the questions that the filmmaker Ryan Gleason was really interested in. He's from Richmond, and he knew the story of this. And this is just an amazing story, because it's basically a nonprofit newspaper that runs out of Cambridge City, Indiana, and they actually now, it's a media empire. They have a paper in Hagerstown, Indiana, and if you're from that part of the state, you know those towns are tiny. And those folks together that are really dedicated, and they put out a weekly, locally owned, locally produced newspaper, they are telling the stories of what's happening. And so Ryan's style as a filmmaker is he likes to just go observe what happens. There's like no voiceover, you know, it kind of is, nobody's like talking to the screen necessarily, but they're kind of showing what it is it like and what does it mean to have this kind of this local journalism, especially, and what does it take to create that and why is it important today?
That sounds like his is more the cinema verite style, isn't it?
It's definitely cinema verite. It's quite charming. The folks who are doing this, they're kind of quirky people. And the people they're interacting with as they go about reporting the news in Cambridge City, Indiana, they're kind of quirky too. But so it's very touching, but it makes you smile a couple times too.
Many of these documentary films come as not only from Northwest Indiana and from Eastern Indiana, but from Southern Indiana, too. And one particular is certainly of interest to our environmental friends here in Northwest Indiana to catch when they're coming to view the films at Valparaiso and later in Gary at IU Northwest is a film that deals with composting, and it's called The Earth Keepers. That's an interesting title for a film. Tell us how Mitch Trubisky and Gabriel Lance came up with that one.
This is a cool story, too. Mitch and Gabriel are both based in Bloomington, and, you know, they're just kind of figuring out what are the weird and interesting stories of what's going on here. And they met these two folks who used to have PhDs in economics from IU and were teaching down at IU, who decided to leave that life behind to start a composting business, that they wanted to do something to make the world greener and more sustainable. And so they collect food waste, among other things, and they compost it. And then they sell that compost. And the neat thing, so it's already kind of an amazing story that they just like leave behind this life in academia, this very kind of normal quote unquote life, and they decide to just do something completely different. But what's also neat is that they work with folks who've been previously incarcerated. So they work with former offenders and to give them these green jobs. And so the workforce of this company are all ex-offenders. And so it's, you know, and the filmmaker talks about, you know, he sees a connection between this idea of kind of wasted food and wasted lives, and that his company is trying to do something about both of those things. And really surprising, and I'm excited for folks to see it.
The last film that's going to be in the Inseparable film series, it'll be on tour starting in January, is from filmmaker Chad Perdue. It's entitled Raised in Contrast, and it is an interesting topic, certainly of interest even in urban sections, but I know it's based on rural Indiana.
Well, so Chad is a first-time documentary filmmaker. He's worked in media production, but he's never made his own film start to finish. And he's biracial, mixed race, and he grew up in a small town in Lebanon, Indiana. And he was just curious about the experience of other people who have grown up mixed race in small towns and suburban communities, you know, and he was, the questions, and I love when a film comes from a filmmaker's personal questions. It almost becomes kind of essayistic, right? And so he's interviewing other people like himself who just have this experience where, you know, when you look at media narratives about who lives in rural places, it often obscures or ignores people of color. And he felt like it was an opportunity to kind of talk about those experiences and show what it's like for those folks. And so that, he interviews people in several small towns in Indiana who, like himself, are people of color, mixed race. And that one, I think, is just such a personal film. And I'm really excited both for, like, Chad's journey of creating that film and then for other people to see it and talk about it.
Once again, this is the Inseparable Film Tour, is the title, from Indiana Landmarks. And it's a series of films from documentary filmmakers that range around the state from northwest Indiana all the way to southern Indiana. And the first of the showings of the films is going to happen on Thursday, January 15th. It'll be at 6:30 in the evening. It's going to be at the Duesenberg Recital Hall, the Center for the Arts at Valparaiso University on campus. With another edition of Eye on the Arts, here's John Kane with South Shore Arts.
Of Eye on the Arts is Micah Bornstein, who is Director of Education at South Shore Arts, who is here to tell us about an exciting upcoming exhibit and education programs related to it.
That's right. The Maurice Sendak Memorial Exhibition will be running at South Shore Arts in the main gallery from February 14th to April 12th. And normally, Bridget Covert, our Director of Exhibitions, would be the person to talk a little bit about this show. But since there's a pretty substantial educational component to it, John invited me to come by and invite teachers and youth groups, be they Big Brothers, Big Sisters, or the Girl Scouts and Boy Scouts, to come to see this exhibition and participate in a monster drawing workshop led by one of our South Shore Arts instructors.
So Maurice Sendak was the author of Where the Wild Things Are, famous children's book.
Yes.
But with a twist, not some nicey-nicey idea of a children's book, but kind of scary about, I think his name is Max.
Yes, Max. Not just scary, but with a sort of impertinent, precocious child who doesn't get his comeuppance in the end, really.
Yeah.
And that's one of the things I've actually find most noteworthy about Maurice Sendak, apart from the wonderful drawings in all of his books, but the element of fear and horror that he thought young people were equipped to deal with, and adults didn't agree always, but young people overwhelmingly delighted in the stories.
So the exhibit preceding the Sendak exhibit, we could mention that too, because we kind of paired the two. It's called Things That Go Bump in the Night, and that's up currently at the Center for Visual and Performing Arts in Munster. And Bridget curated that and selected a number of artists whose imagery is akin to Sendak's in its monstrousness, and it's been very popular.
Yeah, well, very popular, actually.
Very popular, and we've been selling a lot of art out of that exhibit. That's amazing to me that people like these kind of horrific, they're not horrific, they're horrorific images. And so that's the prelude. We're calling the whole thing Wild Things from this first exhibit, then on into the Sendak exhibit. And this is a national nationally touring exhibit. It's been everywhere. It's been at the Museum of Science and Industry once upon a time. It's been at the Disney Family Museum in San Francisco. And so we're quite proud to have it come to us in Munster, Indiana, for the people of Northwest Indiana and south suburbs of Chicago. And I think it's great that we are going to do a lot of programming with it for kids to get their families to bring them in and see it. So there's a family. In fact, there's a family arts day.
Yeah, I mean that's one of the other public events that's in conjunction with this is that we're having the open to the public sort of reception for it on February 23rd, and that is also the family arts day for the Center for Visual and Performing Arts. So in addition to South Shore Arts having the reception for the Maurice Sindeck exhibit, the theater at the center will be participating in this Family Arts Day as well. And South Shore Arts will be holding an open house for our studio art classes. So families, adults, and young people who come will be able to try their hand at some activity that is representative of the classes we offer, be it ceramics or printmaking or drawing.
Mm-hmm. Good.
Give you a little taste of what it might be like to enroll and be able to take advantage of our facility.
Yeah, we like people to come and see what we have available there. And then we're going to have storytelling. We're going to have storytelling every week.
We're
all going to take turns.
We're all going to take turns. I think Bridget has some storytelling prepared for that Family Arts Day, but on Thursdays is when the educational component of this exhibit takes place. So if you're interested in scheduling one of these tours and arts experiences with some reading, then you would want to call me, Micah, the Director of Education, at 219-836-1839, extension 101, or you can call our Education Program Manager, Summer Scheringhausen. Same phone number, but extension 103.
And you can hear this and more conversations on Eye of the Arts on our website right now at lakeshorepublicradio.org. And tune in again next Monday here on Regionally Speaking for Eye on the Arts. And that's it for Regionally Speaking for today. I'm Chris Nolte. Thanks for joining us. Back here tomorrow.